It's Wednesday, January 24th, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Monique Luisi and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, movement in the U.S. House on the passing of a federal shield law. We'll talk about what it would cover and where it goes next. Big moves on the morning after the New Hampshire primary. In addition to the results, we're going to look back at what broke down between DeSantis and the news media and what even he says should have been done differently. And police in a small Colorado town have charged a man who has admitted to stealing every copy of the local newspaper. We'll talk about why the police say that he did it, and how the journalists in the town responded. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our time is up, but we're going to start with the uncertain future of one of the nation's most venerable sports magazines. Friday, Sports Illustrated laid off its entire unionized staff, which made up, well, most of the staff. This happened after the Athena Group failed to pay licensing fees to the parent company. Now, Athena Group is saying it's got every plan to keep publishing with even an 80% staff reduction and what it calls having a substantial debt. But this is a brand that is in trouble. Last month, we were talking about non-transparent creation of content using AI.
Yeah. And, you know, we also, Kathy did, alluded to the fact that this might be what was coming because they've had financial struggles pretty much from the time that Athena bought it and even prior to that. For the previous sale. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how they're going to continue to publish when you've laid off most of your staff. So, again, I think we should be looking for more of the AI-generated content coming out because the only other alternative is to go out and have, you know, stringers or freelancers doing the work. And the problem with that is you're going to have to pay them, too. So if you're having financial problems, how are you going to do that? And, you know, you already had quality control issues, so it's only going to get worse.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but Athena is the same company that also manages Muhammad Ali and Dr. J's brand, I believe.
I think so. I think so.
So I don't think they were as invested as their previous owners. And so this is just an example of how we have to be careful of who's managing the accounts, because if they're not in the game, mentally they're not going to invest in the game.
And I mean, I think part of this was they wanted the brand, but what they didn't really understand was that
there was journalism going on there?
There had to be some sort of journalism going on. And you have to continue to produce in order for that brand to have value. Yeah. And the problem here is that, you know, they by not producing the quality level that the brand is known for, thus the brand becomes diluted. And here you are.
And this is a brand. If we talk about the history of Sports Illustrated, I know people have been sharing their favorite covers since last Friday. Right. A lot of them featuring Mizzou's teams at its best, or I remember seeing two, the women's soccer team after winning the first gold medal. There's a lot of history that has gone on here. And as this brand continues to dilute. Mm-hmm. What is this signaling about the future of what sports journalism really looks like in this country? Because, you know, that whole AI-generated stats, it feeds towards a fantasy and a gambling-focused sports journalism, much less than it does the type of reporting we were seeing that has a legacy of Pulitzer Prizes at Sports Illustrated.
Well, I don't have a complete issue with the use of AI. Yeah. AI could be, if used as a tool effectively,
can
help with making greater gender equality, racial equality in reporting. So we're not talking about Tom Brady's wife, you know, we're talking about Giselle, the model, former wife, that is. But it can use that, AI can be used to help in that regard. However, there still needs to be human eyes that look at the content and are responsible for the content so that there's trust in it and actually that quality that has been diluted, mm-hmm. as you said.
And to me, when it comes to sports, one of the things that you've seen over the course of now, I would say almost more than 20 years, is this slow move toward entertainment, mm-hmm. and it's all about entertainment.
Well, that feeds into Monique's point about Jay-Z.
Absolutely. I mean, and part of it is, you know, this sort of, because it's moved more to television, it's moved more to the digital platforms that they have, it's moved more toward gambling. All of those things are entertainment based and mm-hmm. not necessarily journalism based. But there's still a lot of politics that goes on in sports. It's definitely a business story. It's also a cultural story in how it impacts people's everyday lives. Mm-hmm. And those stories are not covered at the depth that they need to be, because we focus a lot on the personalities and not so much those things.
And so as you talk about those things, there's another story that is on our links blog that the NFL is looking at buying a double-digit stake in ESPN, which it really does beg that question, because ESPN, again, with some of its documentary work, some of its longer form content, opens the door for additional influence of the league, of it being more about entertainment and less about some of those very important issues that you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the NFL wants to buy a stake in ESPN, mm-hmm. but to be honest, they pretty much already have a stake in ESPN because of the contracts. So over the last, I would say, last 10 years, maybe 15 years, you've gone from ESPN having multiple contracts with various sports entities to now the two major is the NFL and college football. Mm-hmm. They dominate not only the airways, but they also dominate who's on the air in terms of the personalities and the people. Mm-hmm. So you have fewer and fewer journalists sports journalists who work for ESPN and who are on the air for ESPN, and more former players and analysts and this sort of thing. And they talk a lot about, again, the personalities, yeah. again, about what's happening in the game, but less about what's happening behind the scenes in many of those entities.
And that's great for human interest and getting people attracted to these stories, but it's definitely to the detriment of reporting, especially if there are issues, not to say that these are common, but they're definitely happening behind the scenes, like CTE and hazing.
Or domestic violence.
Yes, and how these issues are covered. And so it's not only a big financial investment, but there's going to be a lot to look at in how the NFL is going to represent themselves should they acquire the stake.
Right.
Okay, so I do have a quick update for you from last week's program. Remember, we were talking about Kevin Meredith's departure from the Los Angeles Times. This weekend, two more top editors stepped down. And yesterday, those painful layoffs that Ernest had connected to Meredith's departure became public. Patrick Shunxiang's paper laid off at least 115 journalists, according to early reports. That's more than 20% of the paper's staff. This marks one of the largest workforce reductions in the paper's nearly 150-year history. The owner said that this is necessary, that it couldn't lose $30 to $40 million a year without building readership that would also generate ad revenue. And in an interview, he said he was disappointed with the paper's union employees who staged a one-day strike last Friday. So I have to tell you, moving on to something else, I probably owe a bunch of our colleagues an apology. When I got to work yesterday morning, there was a story on one of the TVs outside my office that's tuned to NBC so that we get KOMU programming here in the School of Journalism. And the Today Show was on. And Joe Fryer was reporting on why people are watching TV shows and movies with the subtitles on. The piece made it sound like it was primarily a generational issue that Gen Z likes for the captions to be on so that they can focus better. Well, Gen X and boomers tend to find the captions distracting. And Fryer was attempting to illustrate findings from a survey from YouGov. Take a listen.
Numbers reflected in the Ship household. Who in the family likes watching with subtitles? Just one. 25-year-old Olivia Shipp lives with her parents, Debbie and Lloyd, in California. Olivia, why do you like watching with subtitles?
The audio for what the actors have is so low, it's hard to hear what they're saying and almost sounds like they're mumbling.
She also took her frustrations to TikTok.
They don't put on subtitles. And then they get mad when you don't want to watch TV with them.
And we're like, really, honey? I didn't realize that that was such a problem.
So now we have subtitles on all the time.
Even though her parents also find subtitles distracting.
I've tried to turn them off and I end up changing the color or, you know, something that was really wrong.
So I gotta say here, this really, it struck me, and I urge people to watch the full piece on our links blog. It goes about 4 minutes, and honestly, it ends with the Today Show anchors poking fun at themselves because they, too, can't turn captions on and off. But, Monique, is it just me, or did they miss the boat here on a much larger issue about the accessibility that having captions on all content brings to make something usable for everyone?
I don't think they necessarily miss the boat, but they're kind of just looking at it and not getting on, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So as educators, I think we are very invested in universal design, making content accessible for everyone. I think that humor is a good entry point to this discussion, but it definitely should not be the end of the discussion, especially generationally speaking. I'm a millennial. Mm-hmm. You didn't mention those groups of people. And I think that subtitles are great sometimes and not great others, but it's all about what the purpose is for. And then my father-in-law, who's a part of the boomer generation, he hates subtitles. Like, he will walk out of a theater if a movie has subtitles on it. He actually did recently because he got the wrong ticket for the wrong thing. But the fact that we're even able to have this conversation is wonderful. For people who are neurodiverse, such as myself with ADHD, I find that looking at movies with subtitles, especially if there's lots of colors and actions mm-hmm. going on, definitely helps me focus on the dialogue. And also in learning different languages, but also if you're hard of hearing, so on and so forth. These are wonderful tools that should be accessible. I just think it's comedic insofar as this is a strange hill to plant a flag on. I mean, instead of being dismissive about it, it's definitely an entry point to discussion about why they are important and necessary to have as a function of accessibility.
Yeah, I being a boomer, I remember when closed captions first came out and the conversation centered on accessibility, mm-hmm. making the programs available for people who were either hard of hearing or had hearing loss. That was the main goal of this. And now I will say that, you know, my kids who are millennials, are Gen Z will basically they have them on all the time. Mm-hmm. My wife, who's a boomer, okay, has them on all the time. I think it's just the person. You know, whether or not you feel comfortable with them on. And you're right. There are some programs where, you know, I will put them on because the dialogue is different, accents, that sort of thing. Or the way in which the show is designed, it's pretty sort of calm voice, and I want to be able to hear it without turning it all the way up, so I'll put the
I didn't like, if you watch the whole video, there's one of the people who said just turn the volume up. That does kind of gloss over a lot of
that, that exactly. brings a very that has a very ableist undertone
right,
to it
right.
And I will say, for anybody who may be watching our program, you can click on the auto-generated closed captions, and for anything that goes out over the airwaves, so like network program, it's actually the law that there be closed captions
right.
again, so that it's accessible right. to everyone. The ages,
and there were huge fights about that when it initially came out. I mean, you actually did have TV executives who were complaining about it because they were afraid that it was going to drive viewers away or that sort of thing. And they were also complaining about the cost because there was an additional cost to it because there was a lot of human labor to it initially that you don't have now because of technology.
And that's something I never understand, is at least at the practical and economic value of making things more accessible. First of all, it's the right thing to do. But if you're able to bring more audience members to the table, it seems just self-evident this is something you want to do.
Right.
Well, and you brought up AI and not being anti-AI. This is a great use for AI. Like, as I mentioned, our captions, those are AI generated that we can go ahead later to be able to clean up if there's anything that the machine learning gets wrong. Did the ageism in here bug anyone, or did that one just kind of sit with me as the Gen Xer between the millennial and the boomer?
We are subject to generational stereotypes all the time. I kind of think it's just par for the course. Okay. I mean, but also with like mobile technologies, you can't always you can't listen to everything out loud in public. Mm-hmm. So
right, that's the other part of it. I'm thinking about like people like doom scrolling through reels on TikTok or Snapchat or Instagram. Like, those captions are what makes you be able to do that without people knowing that you're doing that.
That's right. Yeah.
Something a little bit more serious. We've talked a lot in the past few months about efforts to stop local watchdog journalism, usually in the form of frivolous lawsuits that would put an organization out of business to be able to defend. Well, in Ridgeway, Colorado, a man is accused of stealing the newspapers from almost every rack in town, all to keep people from reading a story. Ernest, the story was about a teenage girl who said that she had been raped in the home of the police chief while the rest of the family was inside. The sheriff's department has made, I don't want to say an arrest, they've cited somebody who admitted to this theft. And he said that he did take the papers because he didn't want people to read the story.
He didn't want people to read the story, which is problematic because there's so many other ways to get that story. And there were so many other news outlets that were covering the story, taking the newspapers off of the rack. You know, you may have, you know, that may have been maybe what? 1% of
and it was apparently 250 papers.
Well, right. It's a small town in Colorado, so maybe that paper has some influence that we're not knowing about, like on the ground. And so, maybe it's the seeing it, the physically being there on the street.
Yeah,
that may be
the issue. But I mean, again, like I said, when you're talking about an incident that happened in the home of a police chief who was at the home at the time, upstairs apparently sleeping, not knowing what was going on. I mean, it's a serious crime, but these things have happened before where people have, you know, gone and taken all the newspapers and in hopes of the story not getting out. I mean, it happens on college campuses, mm-hmm. at least it used to, a lot, when there was a story that the campus newspaper broke and then somebody goes and collects them all and then there's a, you know, there's an investigation and somebody finds out who's done it, that sort of thing. So this is not anything new, but to see it happen now when you have fewer and fewer people who actually read the physical copy of the newspaper, I find it a little funny.
So the staff, their reaction was to send out an email blast to anybody that subscribed. And it was ultimately picked up by the Associated Press, by several national newspapers. That's how it came to our attention. And in that email blast, they said, like, we're not going to be silenced. This just makes us want to double down on the reporting. Here's the link to the story they didn't want you to read.
Right.
Right?
So it's like they brought more. I mean, if this was an attempt to bring more attention to the story, great.
Yeah, they got it.
Not failure.
Okay, so here's the part that's also kind of interesting is they followed up after this citation was issued, after the person had admitted to it, and they named the person who admitted to the theft. And they aren't explaining how or why or what his connection to the story is. Thoughts there?
I kind of wondered about whether or not they had enough information to do that.
Okay.
That was the first thing that popped in my mind, was like, maybe they just don't know yet and they're trying to figure out what the connection might be. It's what I also find interesting is that, you know, the law enforcement agency who's doing that part of it is the same law enforcement agency that is run by the sheriff. So I'm wondering if there could be some sort of connection there. more information needs to be
reported out
public.
Here.
Yes, made public.
Okay. Well, we've got another small victory, a win of a battle in a war, if you will. It came last week as the U.S. House passed unanimously the Press Act. It's a federal shield law decades in the making. Now, it passed the House, which means it needs to go to the Senate. Chances for forward movement here?
I think so. I think this might be the year that it actually makes it.
What makes you think this year is because this is decades.
Well,
in the
making. if it can get through the House,
yeah,
in a bipartisan vote, mm-hmm, then it's likely to get through the Senate also in a bipartisan vote. And there's been very little, at least so far, opposition in the Senate to this, whereas there was definite opposition in the House prior to this vote. So I think it's a possibility. And the fact that you have a shield law in a majority of the states right now. The problem is that those shield laws don't have any impact on federal agencies. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're really concerned about. And I think that there's a belief in both parties that you need to have this because there have been violations of the state shield laws at the federal level by both Democratic and Republican administrations. And that's, I think, what's fueling this.
And I think this is also exciting because it makes it more uniform, as you're discussing, at the federal level, but also with the distrust in media that's rampant, hopefully this will lend a little bit of credibility back to people trusting in media, especially, and then also if sources coming forward if they feel more protected.
Yeah.
So if this federal shield, and I think you started to touch on this, there are states that don't have a shield law. Right. If this is passed, how might that change things for journalists in those states? Would it only apply on the federal level, or would it give them greater protection in other reporting they'd be doing too?
I think that there's going to be an even stronger push at the state level in those states that do not have a mm-hmm. shield law. And it may even have some states that have weak shield laws go back and take a look at those laws so that they can conform to what's being made legal at the federal level.
And that's especially important given the reach of news and how different people, different sources might be from different states, different nations even. So that uniformity will definitely help.
well, and it's also kind of interesting too, as we think about, like we were talking last week about things going on down in Jefferson City and what that might mean for our state sunshine law. With this with the potential, definitely, of a shield law on the federal level that might strengthen other shield laws, in some ways it could kind of counteract if sunshine laws or Freedom of Information Acts are strengthened.
Right.
That people would feel safer perhaps going and talking to a reporter, knowing that their identity, like there could be balance if one becomes stronger while one becomes weaker.
Well, no, I agree. And what's really needed here, because you're seeing it more and more where it's a lot of what's happening is that journalists are being taken to court and asked to turn over their records. They're trying to weaponize certain legal loopholes that have led to journalists being basically hauled into court, or as we talked about in previous shows, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and others basically being hauled into court, yeah, by the Trump administration to turn over evidence in an investigation of the president and his administration. And so those are types of things have happened on a state level involving governors, attorney generals, secretaries of state. This type of law can provide protection for journalists in doing the basic job of covering this.
So while we're talking about federal government stuff, let's talk for a minute about what went on in New Hampshire last night. Mm-hmm. No big surprises at all. Everything went exactly as we would have predicted a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago.
Yes.
I mean, really.
It did. I mean, yes. I was talking to someone about this the other day.
Yeah.
This election has already been scripted.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like watching a show, a drama play out. Even though you know that what's going to happen at the end, you still have this a little bit of intrigue. Nikki Haley probably getting enough of the independent vote to make it a close,
to be sustainable, for a little bit longer.
You know, keep the drama going. That's sort of the way it's playing out. But ultimately, you know what the end's going to be.
So the big incremental development in the last week is that we are now down to two.
Yes.
One of the things that's been really interesting about that is DeSantis's acknowledgement, perhaps, maybe that's the right word, that maybe he didn't play things in the best way with the press. Maybe he didn't have those relationships work to his advantage.
No, and I think they say hindsight is 2020, but it's too late in this case for him. I mean, there was the relationship he had with the press, but there was also his attack on a certain little company that's worth a lot of money, Disney. And so, you know, it's like that seemed to be a big distraction from his campaign. Don't mess with Disney.
I guess apparently that's our theme at the beginning of the show and the end as we talk about the NFL.
Well, I mean, you know,
ESPN, don't mess with Disney.
But
the other thing too is that you had political reporters in the state of Florida who said that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. They predicted it. They said, look, what he does and how he handles his campaigns work in certain parts of Florida enough for him to be able to generate the voting base to be able to win a statewide election. But that was not going to play on a national level. And he did all those things that he's done in Florida, and it didn't play out.
So how do we, as journalists in different parts of the country, or journalists who are working nationally, like, that's a really big thing that journalists missed out on, was not listening to their peers who knew that candidate, knew their MO, and knew exactly what their approach was going to be, to follow that with context and explain that process.
Well, I mean, I think in this case, in some ways it did. And because they covered him initially, but then when he kept doing the same things, especially avoiding the national media, they sort of went like, hey, you know, if you're not going to talk to us, there are other candidates in this election.
We're going to talk to them
and we'll ask them about you. And that's, I think, one of the mistakes that he made that he has not owned up to.
Yeah, when you're running a country or trying to run a country, it's the whole country that you have to take into consideration. And so you can have a very successful local politician, but if they're not adjusting their strategies for the national audience, then it's time and money not well spent.
Ernest, you talked about the idea of the episodic nature of what the 2024 elections are going to look like. We saw a rerun over the weekend as Donald Trump banned an NBC reporter from an event.
We're going to see more of that. It's going to happen. I mean, this is going to play out a lot like 2016
and 2020.
And you know, here we go again. The question becomes, how will the media change its coverage of this election?
Yeah. Well, we've got about 8 months to keep having that conversation. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. We are just about out of time. We invite you to read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. I'd like to thank Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Takia Thomas for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.